Monster Man, bonus episode, June 2021.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a bonus episode put out as a thank you to all of you who subscribe to the Patreon at the $1 level. And normally in these bonus episodes, I go over like the things I've been reading over the month, the gaming products I've bought, the games I've played, all that kind of thing. And there's a little bit of a problem this month, kind of as there was last month, which is that I have been drowning in deadlines. My late June deadline turned into a mid-June deadline, turned into an end-of-June deadline, and I'm about to go away on a holiday that I hadn't even told my colleagues I had booked because it didn't seem relevant, right? It was a month after our deadline, but in fact, we have only just finished, or I should say I have only just finished. They're still hard at work getting the things done that we needed to get done. So I hope that it's going to result in a product that people are going to have a lot of fun reading and playing, but it does mean that that has been mostly what I've been thinking about. That and the Pamphlet of Pantheons. The Pamphlet of Pantheons print pamphlet, there's a lot of plosives in that sentence. Anyway, the print copies of the Pamphlet of Pantheons arrived, and I have been getting them out the door to backers. And of course, for the first part of the month, I was kind of finalizing the design. I know nothing about the principles of good layout or anything like that, but I feel like I've got better at using the software, which I guess is good. I don't know. But so yeah, the result is that I don't know that I've read a new gaming thing since the last time we spoke. I have queued up a couple of things either on my Kindle or actually like put them in my bag for my upcoming trip, including the new Black Iron Legacy novel, which I've been meaning to read this entire month by Gareth Hanrahan, who of course appeared as a guest on this show. And I did get a copy of Peterson's Field Guide, but that is something that I already had the original Cthulhu Mythos one. And I flipped through it and admired the pretty art. There is something about the first artist you encounter, or the first art style that you encounter in a role-playing game, that kind of defines the look of that for you. And I think that that is the reason that I am more open to this, the beautiful, you know, fancy, schmancy, chaosium art style in RuneQuest than I am in Call of Cthulhu. Because for RuneQuest, you know, my first real exposure to Glorantha, I'd always been aware of it, but my first real exposures to it were things that didn't, like, have a lot of art, like the Raelios Wilds campaign, which was published in a zine that was included in the APA Interregnum, or King of Dragon Pass, which has lots of nice art, but a lot of which is really grounded in this kind of, not realistic necessarily, but sort of human scale sort of imagery. And so when I see that, you know, it looks totally different in current Chaosium products, but there's some aspect of that humanness that I think connects in my mind King of Dragon Pass, even though King of Dragon Pass has this much more Celtic-y, Scandinavian-y look to its Orlanthe than the more kind of, I don't know, the Thracians or ancient Greeks or whatever they're supposed to be that they are now. But the fancy modern Call of Cthulhu art so little resembles Tom Sullivan that I can't quite get to grips with it. And that was true when 5th edition came out. So they've announced the 40th anniversary Call of Cthulhu Kickstarter. Logic says that I should not back it because I do have most of those products already. Not that I got them when they came out, because I would have been under 10 years old, but I got them, you know, on secondhand shelves at a time when they were not that old. You know, I quite enjoyed collecting older Call of Cthulhu things that were out of print, which of course is now almost everything that I own for the game. But really, the presence of a 40th anniversary Kickstarter mainly made me feel a certain awkward yearning resulting from the fact that as a gift, my wife got me the 20th. I mean, she wasn't my wife then, we were just dating, but she got me the 20th anniversary edition. So that itself, which to me feels a little too modern and highfalutin, is already 20 years old. So that's a very long roundabout explanation of why I don't necessarily feel like I have a huge amount to contribute. This is weird because I know that I've got things. Like, again, I sometimes feel like I acquire more gaming products when I cannot actually read and enjoy them. Get like more Kickstarter stuff. Like it's a, like me, lots of other Zine Quest projects have you know, started to arrive, it being now like, what, 4 months after Zine Quest. That seems like a pretty good length of time for the project. So The Drain, which is a scenario for the Mothership RPG. I backed that and that arrived. The Journal of Fantastic Linguistics, I think the pre-press version arrived. The pre-press of Where the Wheat Grows Tall, a scenario that I backed, arrived, which I have no idea anything about it other than its beautiful artwork. You know, I have this is the pre-release in front of me, but I don't really want to talk about it in terms of the monsters in it because, you know, it's not out yet. And I feel like that would be sort of, that would be kind of contrary to the spirit of the thing. Although just looking through them, they are marvelous. They got a real folklore kind of feel to them that is enhanced by Evelyn Moreau's art style. You know, if I had not previously seen Evelyn Moreau's stuff and you told me that someone had found like an old book of, you know, illustrated Czech fairy tales or something and taken these images from that and then written the scenario around them, I would believe you. If my holiday sounds to you like it's going to be a lot of me sitting around reading, you are right. I plan to read, walk the dog, and maybe like go to a secondhand bookshop, but that's probably it. After a busy month, I'm going to reward myself with a whole lot of doing nothing. I didn't even really run any games that interestingly had monsters in them because I ran a huge battle scene in my Other Dust game, but we're getting to the point in Other Dust where we're getting towards the end, I think that's no big secret, of the campaign. And what that means is that primarily what we're seeing are older enemies, right? Like this is the time when we are finishing up the final conflict with old antagonists. So the very first session of the Other Dust game began with the characters all prisoners, you know, having been captured by a gang who were going to, you know, take them to be effectively sold into slavery in a place called Emerald Lake. And in the next session, after 3 or 4 years of play, they are going to Emerald Lake. They're going to actually be in that place that they've heard so much about and they've encountered the agents of, but they've never actually been there. But what that means is that I don't even have like new fun monsters to talk about because for the most part, you know, this is where we're wrapping things up. I guess the only really monster related thing I've been doing lately is watching Godzilla Singular Point on Netflix. I like Godzilla, but in a kind of non-systematic way. I have built up structures in my life to guard against going down fandom rabbit holes because I know that they take you a long way and a lot of the time the further you go, the more kind of you get diminishing returns. So I don't ever want to be like, oh, I'm a Godzilla guy. If I see a Godzilla thing, I have to buy it. You know, it's simpler and safer to be fans of things that are comparatively obscure because it means that you don't wind up with that problem. And then so that does happen to something that I really like Delta Green, I actually kind of stopped being a Delta Green guy because there's just so much of it to keep up with. And I could be a Delta Green guy and have a bunch of intensity about Delta Green back when there wasn't really all that much of Delta Green to buy. Now, just impractical. Anyway, my point is that I'm watching Godzilla Singular Point. I have no idea how it ties into the broader Godzilla mythos. I don't think it does, in the same way that I don't think Godzilla Planet of the Monsters did. And I actually think that's really interesting. I think that points to Godzilla being a monster that is recontextualizable in the same way that something like Dracula is. Like, all of these various Godzilla media have those same themes about the destructive potential of science, about ecology, humans as like little underdog characters. You know, all of those things that you would sort of expect in a Godzilla story. And they have, you know, giant monsters wrecking stuff, but also they're not consistent with each other. And I think that's really fascinating. You know, in the same way that no one would expect two Dracula movies from two different directors to be consistent with each other, you know, in terms of what their Dracula was and what it did. Like, I wonder if we are seeing Godzilla moving into that space, which is interesting because, you know, you think of Godzilla as, you know, a single movie studio's output, right? There's I don't know. But again, I don't know that much about the history of the franchise, so maybe I'm wrong. It does use a lot of the signals from those earlier films, which I think is really interesting. So the first time you see something that might be Godzilla, you get that bum, 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 Godzilla theme. And Of course, you get the Godzilla roar, right? The skreeonk. And there are kind of like inclusions of elements from other parts of the Godzilla mythos, for want of a better word. So the reason that I decided to watch it was that I saw in the description of one of the episodes that my favorite Godzilla character, Jet Jaguar, is in it. And so I find that type of monster very interesting. I feel like Godzilla is in that creative sweet spot where you can incorporate concepts from a Godzilla thing into something. You know, it's not so tight that you can't deviate from the canon, but it's also not so loose that it could just mean anything. I feel like there are monsters you can do that with in games. I mean, dragons are probably the classic example, but though actually I feel like dragons may be at the point where they could mean anything. I think if you decided to do a dragon that was really kind of based on how dragons appear in the legends and literature of medieval Europe, you would almost alienate your players, because that is not how they anticipate dragons. But at the same time, having a big D&D style, you know, fifth ed gargantuan ancient red dragon or whatever the heck, kind of feels like reducing this thing that should be a mythical presence to a purely tactical challenge. So dragons are a bit like that. I get the feeling that Cthulhu is a little bit like that. I watched Lovecraft Country. That's another thing that I've done. You know, when I've had some time, Allison and I have been watching Lovecraft Country. Lovecraft Country is a thing we've been watching together. Godzilla Singular Point is a thing that I've been watching by myself. I usually watch about 10 or 15 minutes of Godzilla before going to sleep. I don't know why, but it's a very, like, because it's action-packed, full of robot fights and stuff, but it still sends me right to sleep. So I've been very gradually watching it. But Lovecraft Country is a little bit like that, right? Because it takes those concepts, well, very loosely takes those concepts. You know, early on, it takes some elements of Lovecraftian horror, but then blends them with other genres and with other ways of kind of looking at the legacy of American horror fiction, I guess, and goes in some very different directions with them. I liked it. Allison really liked it. I liked it. I thought there were areas where I could kind of see what it was trying to do, but that maybe it hadn't landed as well as it wanted to. But overall, I was pretty pleased with it. And I understand why people who were hoping for something more conventionally Lovecraftian were disappointed. But at the same time, I think the show makes an excellent case for why it needs to not fall prey to, you know, feeling a need to be conventionally Lovecraftian. At least that's what I felt. So I guess that's another thing. And so I think that you can do that, like take a resident name, take some resident images, and put them in a game and have them be different. And I wonder, you know, what that would look like for Dungeons & Dragons. Parentheses, it would look like the comic book Die, James. That's exactly what it would look like, close parentheses. But, you know, maybe it would be more than that. Like, I just, a little bit like, you can see this in Stranger Things, right? Where the use of D&D names like Demogorgon or Mind Flayer lend resonance to something, but the specific D&D-ness of those is not important other than to locate the story on a, you know, one of the reasons that I think D&D in the 80s is such a useful narrative tool for Stranger Things is that the concerns, you know, the sort of satanic panic D&D concerns, right, were initially at least rooted in this idea that people would forget the boundary between fantasy and reality when they played Dungeons & Dragons. I read a really fascinating book about this, whose author I can't remember off the top of my head, but he pointed out that initially criticisms of Dungeons & Dragons were not rooted in, like, satanic panic stuff, but in the idea that the game presented this type of imaginative activity that would cause players to forget that they were, you know, in the real world, and to engage in the kind of, like, antisocial, violent behavior the player characters behave in. Because the D&D panic actually predates a lot of the mainstreaming of the satanic panic just slightly, right? The James Dallas Egbert stuff isn't satanic panic stuff at all, initially. Anyway, point is that watching Godzilla Singular Point and Lovecraft Country, you know, those are both examples of ways in which monsters can be recontextualized to produce new and different effects. And that does sometimes mean giving up something that monster originally had. So, for example, the creatures that are called Shoggoths in Lovecraft Country are not, in any Lovecraftian sense, Shoggoths. It's just that Shoggoth is the best monster name in Lovecraft. Some people feel that Lovecraft is not in that space where you can use it and repurpose it in different ways. So S.T. Joshi's, whatever it's called, The Rise and Fall and Rise of the Cthulhu Mythos, is all just him identifying stories that he personally doesn't like because they don't fit his particular conception of what the mythos is. But the nature of what Lovecraft was doing, particularly in terms of collaborating with other writers, or not even collaborating, but allowing other writers a space to play with his creations, I think precludes that kind of static approach to his work. This was not a Lovecraft sequel, and was never meant to be. This is not a story about the continuity of the Godzilla films, and was never meant to be. This is not a Dungeons & Dragons adventure updated to, you know, small town Indiana in the 80s, and it was never meant to be. Okay, boy, that wound up going off onto a different track, but in short, watching these things has made me think about how to take some of the monster concepts here and like use them in other ways. I guess I've sort of always been doing that with my other Dust game, but there it was more of a like mechanical gimmick thing. You know, I had a blanket catch-all mutant creature monster explanation, and that allowed me to just do whatever I wanted. And so I was just looking for gimmicks that could make fights fun. But if I were running a different type of game, and that's probably not the case, like whatever the game I run next is likely to be a more or less conventional fantasy game, because that's the idea that's pestering me right now. But I still think that there's something there. I still think that there's something in like having the name of a bugbear and then turning out to be something slightly different. Or though the one that I intend to use is Night Gaunt, right? There is going to be a creature in that setting called the Night Gaunt, but it's not exactly going to be a Lovecraftian Night Gaunt. But I'm just using the name to evoke the right mood. I want you to feel about this monster the way you would feel about a Night Gaunt. I want you to feel the thrill of recognition when you hear someone say the name Godzilla, or at least that I feel. Perhaps you don't feel the same way about Godzilla. All right, well, I'm sorry that my rambling has been inconclusive. I hope that next month I'll be able to give you like a much more concrete set of like reviews, effectively, because I will actually read some of this big pile of gaming material that is stacking up here, you know, in my virtual to-read pile, and that I just haven't been able to read this month. But hopefully things will calm down a bit, and I'll be able to get through it and look at some fun monsters and talk to you about them then. So apologies for this unfocused bonus episode. Our next episode is going to be a proper listener special, in which I'm going to talk about creating monsters using the exquisite corpse method. So that's going to be coming up in the next episode of Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.